All right, everybody, good morning. Hello and welcome to the Staying Out of the Pitfalls of Half Measures panel discussion. My name is Aaron, and I am a compulsive overeater and a 100-pounder.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi, everybody. While the topic of this panel is staying out of the pitfalls of half measures, and the speakers all have experience in this particular area, this panel is open to everyone. We will each introduce ourselves and qualify and speak for 20 minutes on the topic of not getting stuck in the sand traps of working some aspects of the program, but perhaps not all aspects of the program, and be stuck on this half measure plateau in either our physical or spiritual recovery. Is there someone in the audience who would be willing to time this panel discussion today? Cool. Please give each speaker a 10-minute warning, and then a 5-minute warning, and then finally a 2-minute warning. All right, thank you very much. And okay, our first speaker is Jack.
Okay, 10 minutes? 20 minutes. 20 minutes. I like 30 and 30, Margaret. Hi, I'm Jack. I'm a compulsive overeater. What a great, great topic. It's a great topic because I got fun stories, but I got fun stories for any topic. I've been around for 34 years. I turned 34. I turned 34, a week or two ago, and I never expected to be here this long. I never expected to be alive this long. No, for real. My mom died at 44, and unbeknownst to me, my sister always thought if she made it to 45, that'd be a victory. That's all she asked for in life, and my sister's 62 now. But I never thought that way. I was 305 pounds by the time I was 18. And I did not envision much past about 25 if I thought about it. And I tried not to think about it. And I won't go into the history of the history, but rest assured I belong here. I'm a 100-pounder. I lost it all and gained it all back. When food didn't fix it, I added alcohol and stolen Valium. I would steal the Valium from my father, who was still keeping a stash from my mother, who had been who had passed away years before. And we didn't talk about it. I had lunch yesterday with the one kid in elementary school and junior high who was fatter than me. And, I've stayed in touch with him and, we've become friends. So I've known him for a long time. I turned 63 last year. And when I came here, I was 29 and a half. So just that you get the idea that I earned my seat. I had two failed careers. One of them 4.5, which is a fairly lengthy amount of time to devote to something that didn't pan out. And the other one was I went to law school, which is 3 years and many, many thousands of dollars for something that I could not, I say did not, but could not pursue. And so I graduated, ran out of gas, did not take the bar exam, took it once because I felt guilty. I come from a long line of Eastern European guilt-ridden people, and so I only went to law school. Now I can see because it's somewhere written. It's the 11th commandment in the Old Testament that very few people know about. But when you grow up where I grew up, there were a fair number of expectations. I went to Fairfax High School over here, and the expectation is if you were smart, you went to a good high school, a good college rather. And if you weren't as smart, you wound up at SC and UCLA and places like where I went. And for real, I mean, I went to UCLA, and it's a nice place to go, but it's not a college. So that was the pressure I had. And by the time I was 29 and a half and I got here, many of my friends were married. Some of them had already put a down payment on the first house in Encino. Many of them had their first, so they had a mortgage, they had all this stuff. I came here, you guys were dealing with mortgages and marriages, and I was dealing with like, lunch. And, the night that I was sold on program, I'll end with this part, I went to a meeting because there was nowhere else to go. It was in January, which is the, great, bastion of, tomorrow. It's the coup de grace that's bigger than Monday and bigger than the first of the month. And so I came to Beverly Hills High School on Monday night, January 5th. Margaret was probably there, my life's never been the same. I got swept up. The only thing comparable is the one time I ever went river rafting, and they said if you fall out, take this, pre-program, if you fall out, don't flail, let go, surrender, go with the flow. And I told these guys in no uncertain terms what they could do with that advice. And then, because that was my nature, I voluntarily threw myself out of the boat at the end of about 90% of the run. and I did exactly what they told me to, and I wound up at the bottom safe and sound and laughing. And so I went to Beverly Hills on that Tuesday night. It wasn't particularly heavy, but I had so much shame. I had the shame of the stretch marks. I had the shame of the 300 pounds. I had the shame of gaining it all back. And once you do that, see, the first time I lost it, I was convinced no symptom, no problem. And so I went out and assumed there was no problem, and I did really at UCLA get a new car, a new suit, a new briefcase, and a new girlfriend. And by the time I was done with college in 3 years, because I was in a big hurry to go Lord knows where, and into law school, I had already gained it back. So I had a lot of shame, a lot of humiliation. Also, my mother died when I was 14, which it shouldn't be humiliation. It should be a lot of other things, but I had a lot of shame about that because I already stood out enough. I couldn't tuck my shirt tails in, and I had a really kind of creepy crew cut, and I was fat, and I had a dead mother, and which made me a unique group of one, and or I felt that way. Law school was no better, and so when I came here, I was pretty bottomed out. And to show you how the first meeting did not save my ass, I left Beverly Hills High School to go to 9th and Wilshire, where I lived, and I stopped virtually at any 7-Eleven or liquor store that there was between there and there. Santa Monica, Wilshire, Santa Monica, Wilshire, Santa Monica, Wilshire. Last one, I promised, last one ever, 25 cents, bag of potato chips, bag of M&Ms. Last one, except for the next one and the next one and the next one. And I got home, I fell asleep. And I love to say this, but it's a God's honest truth. I woke up. First of all, the shades were drawn. The phone was off the hook. I was leaning back in my Naga hide recliner. I don't know why that word's so funny. And the hide of a Naga. And nothing was any different when I woke up that morning. I had pieces of M&M shells and Ruffles potato chips. But my life's never been the same from that day. The part that's relevant to this topic actually is about 4 years ago, my sponsor said, and mind you, I never stopped going to meetings. I have virtually never not had a sponsor. I have virtually never not sponsored. And I never went three consecutive terms, a year and a half, without having some service commitment. And my sponsor, after working with him, I had one sponsor for 6 years, one for 6 years, and I've been with the current guy for almost 24 years. He said to me 4 years ago, when I was being rebellious in any number of ways, complacent and rebellious, but my weight stayed, you know, I did get too thin in this program. If any of you have battled that, my low weight is 158. I'm 6 feet tall. I look like, and I don't mean to be silly, but in the early 80s, if you were a male at 158 and 6 feet tall, people would come up to you and say, oh, I'm so sorry. They thought that you had AIDS probably. Because many of our brothers and sisters were beginning to die of that. And the more they said how bad I looked, the better I felt, because I finally didn't have the burden of that weight. I finally fit in until I got too skinny. And so 4 years ago, he said to me, you're going to program, but you're not working a program. And if you don't want to work a program, what do you need me for a sponsor for? And I panicked. Because the day that I went and got him, 20-something years earlier, there were only two people I was looking for. I was looking for him or Natalie. And by 4 years ago, Natalie was beginning her decline, and I knew that wasn't a viable option. And there was nobody, partly in arrogance, partly in fear, that had what I wanted. I would have found somebody else, but thank God I didn't need to. And quite surprising to me, because I have a organic pull to being rather lazy, I think is the technical term. I really am. The one left over from the olden days, other than stretch marks, man, if I could sit behind, you know, in my chair and watch TV and you bring me lunch and dinner, I'll take an IV. I don't give a shit. I'll do it. I'm just kind of, you know, I'd like to say mellow. The truth is it's lazy. And I got scared, I guess. And that's never motivated me much. I mean, the bar exam being tomorrow, I actually got drunk the weekend before the Tuesday of the bar exam. It didn't scare me. Nothing scared me. I didn't care about anything enough. So when this sponsor who I'm trying to practice the principles in all my affairs by not even mentioning his name. He said, you know, there's no reason. Reread the traditions. Reread the steps. So, you know, I'm not even going to tell you who he is. He said, you're not working a program. And what do you want me to do? I want you to read. I want you to write in your food because I don't want to hear about your food anymore. Get a food sponsor. I'm 30 years in program. I haven't had a food sponsor in 25 years. I haven't written in my food to anybody. I heard, I think it was Michael B. once say, the line was about to tell somebody the exact nature of my food. Shit, I don't want to do that. I'll show you my checkbook. I'll tell you about my sex stuff. I'll tell you about anything. Don't mess with my food. I don't want to tell you what it is. I don't want to tell you where it is. I don't want to tell you how much it is. I don't want to tell you when it is. I don't want to lie to you, so don't ask me. I won't lie. I don't lie about that. I just don't tell anybody. So now, 4 years ago, I got a food sponsor. This is bizarre. We're all impulsive or we're not. I haven't missed one day in 4 years of sending in my food, including everything I eat. I haven't cheated. I haven't lied. Nothing. I'm kind of, if I'm married to a page in the big book, other than the third edition, page 449, about acceptance, which somehow is now 417 or whatever it is, it's page 482 in the third edition about honesty. It's in the last paragraphs of the story written by a woman. So why they took that story out is beyond me, because they were replacing stories with women, young people, people of color, and gay and lesbian people. But they took the story out, and it was called Belle of the Bar. And in Belle of the Bar, the paragraph about this long about honesty, to me, is what has saved my ass, because it says, it's the easiest word for me to know about because it's the exact opposite of everything I've done all my life. I went to my father to make amends about something about 20 years ago, and I said, Dad, I'd like to sit down with you. And he got worried. He said, I'd like to tell you something. And he got more worried. I said, I've been lying to you. And I don't know where his mind went about what I was lying about. So he sits down, he takes a deep breath, and he says, explain it to me, Lucy. And I said that every time I've come to your house, which has been many, many times over the years, and told you, oh, my God, I got 11 minutes because I got to leave in 6 minutes because I got to be somewhere that takes 5 minutes to get to, I've never had anywhere to go and no time to be there. And he said, I know. I said, you know? That was another one of my lies. I'd go there. I'd use the bathroom. I'd borrow money. I take a vacuum cleaner. I mean, I need a vacuum cleaner. And my dad didn't care. I mean, he really didn't care. He was so sweet. I take some food out of the refrigerator, and then I leave because I had to be somewhere. I didn't have to be anywhere. I was just uncomfortable with people and relationships. So I told them that, and I had to come clean. So this page about honesty really got to me. So I got a food sponsor now. I haven't missed a day. I count things. I count pistachio nuts. I count them. I'm 34 years in a program. I'm a California licensed psychotherapist with 27 years of experience licensed, 30-something years in the field. I'm over 60 years old. I've been married in double-digit years now. And I tell somebody the exact nature of my food. Idiotic? Not even remotely. Not even remotely. I write every day. Not a lot. I read every day. And the worst thing is, he told me to call before 7. That's fine. So the first day I called him at 7:03. And got into an argument with him when he busted me on it. And halfway through the argument, I just started to laugh because he was 100% right. I hadn't let go absolutely. I was still doing it my way. If you want what I have, do what I do, Judy H. is known to say. You do what I do, you'll get what I got. It's not real simple. It's not real complicated. So I argued for 5 minutes until I realized the absurd nature of my arrogance, my fear, my obstinance, and a few other glorious character defects. And now I call him every morning. If I accidentally, which is really all it is now, don't call him. I call him and not make amends because it's to me, really, but I explain it. About once or twice a month, I really have busy days now. I have a full life from a lot of angles. I will forget to write or not have time or not make time. That's the other thing he busted me on. I can't say I don't have time. There's no way to not have enough time to write and read, guys. I mean, no offense. So I reframe that when I'm sponsoring somebody because that's another form of self-deception. To say I didn't choose to do it is true. To say I didn't make the time to do it, to say I didn't want to do it, that's all true. To say I didn't have time is a nice, convenient lie. And if I'm going to fine-tune my program, if the road's really going to get narrower, if I really want to be what I have an obligation to be after 34 years, I can't do that. So if I don't write that day, I tell him. In the beginning of this process, I would lie. I would lie on the lies that I could even fool myself with. I didn't have time. Then I went to the phase of, let me tell you why, and give him 75 details, none of which mattered. Not to me, not to him. Now, if I don't do it, it's because I didn't do it. And it's awkward for me to be responsible. I was lying. When I was 6 years old or 7 years old, a friend of mine who was a thug in the neighborhood stole a bicycle. And he wanted me to help him. And I was a good Jewish boy. And we don't, you know, Jews don't steal bicycles. Jews don't do a lot of things. And so, most of which we actually do. And I wouldn't do that. But then Joey said, can I hide the bike in your backyard? I was afraid of Joey, so I said, sure, hide it in my backyard. The police came. Now let me tell you, the police in the 50s were Barney and Andy. We had no police. We had no juvenile delinquency. We had no battery. We had no drug use. We had nothing. We had nothing. For a cop to come to your house in the 50s, you had to be like somewhere between Charles Manson and Adolf Eichmann. I mean, it wasn't likely to happen. Cop comes, and I remember keeping as straight face as I could for as long as I could as I cried and screamed that I didn't know anything about the bike. I was hiding behind my mother, initially afraid of the cop, until I realized I was afraid of my mother. Throw in the fact that my mom used to hit me. And so I didn't have a safe haven. But you know what? I have a loving higher power today that's not going to hit me. I have a loving sponsor today who works in the spirit of that loving higher power, so that if I tell him the truth, what's he going to do? First of all, what can another adult do to me anyway? When I hear an adult say to me, you know what, if I did that at work, I'd get in trouble. I don't mean to be disrespectful. I say, what does that look like for an adult? How do you get in trouble? You might get written up. That's what adults do. They might get fired. That can happen to an adult. But you can't get in trouble anymore. So it just doesn't exist. It's a construct that doesn't exist unless it's in the magnificence of my mind. And so I tell him the truth to the best of my recollection, the best of my ability. And you know what? If I catch myself after, I come clean. And to the best of my ability. And I can say that now and not have to look over my shoulder to see who's laughing at me or with me. So if you're new, the one thing I want to suggest is don't leave no matter what. In the beginning, I lied about my food. I lied about my weight. I lowered the numbers when that made me look better. And when I got too low, I raised the numbers to make me look better, to get people off my back. I lied about what I was eating because I was too scared to tell the truth and too scared to eat enough. And you know what? But I never left. And because I never left, I was here for the miracle slowly, sometimes quickly. I saw other people get it quicker. I saw other people never get it. I saw how many people, Margaret, Lonnie, die of our disease. You know, those of us who've been around for a long time, what it's really hammered home is not only how this disease really does kill. It really does kill. I forget that. I was getting coffee today at a 7-Eleven, and this lunatic was talking to some woman and bantering, and he said, well, she said something about, oh, he was grabbing up all the coffee or something, and I said, put your head under there and just tilt your head under it and, you know, have it. I said, do it IV. And he made some comment about being a recovering alcoholic. And I said, no wonder you have that kind of relationship with coffee. And he laughed. I said, how much time do you have? And he pumped up and said, 1 year and 3 months. And I was so impressed. I told him so. He gets to the cash register, and he didn't look like he had a lot. He didn't look like he had a lot. And he whispered something to the cashier. And I could hear her. I could hear him. But she didn't understand what he went. What he was saying is he had cooked a deal with the management to only charge him for a small when he got a big. And I think he said it quietly because there was a line there. But I heard him. And she had no idea what he was talking about, and from his look, could very easily assume he was lying. To be honest, I don't think he was lying. And so I said, oh, let me cover my friend's coffee. And he turned around and he smiled, and I had said to him I was in OA, and his response just felt so touching. He said, OA, it's the same 12 steps, that addiction is bad. He said, it's OA, it's whether it's drugs, whether it's alcohol, whether it's food, I forget that. I forget that I went to an OAAA dance my first year of program, and I went up to this beautiful woman, and I couldn't ask her. I couldn't talk to her. She was pretty, and all I was an ex-fat guy in OA, which is not a big, you know, no tattoos, no narcotics, no chains. I didn't drive a Harley. I was a Jewish guy from West LA. And I said, I'm only in OA. And this woman looked at me and said, only? It's the same disease. It's the same 12 steps. Basically welcome. And I forget that. I forget that. So if you're new, don't leave. But the road does get narrower, but don't worry. It's like people worrying about their fourth step when they haven't taken their first step yet. Don't worry. It's about, I'm afraid of I can't join this program. I will never be able to make amends for what I did. That's 9 steps from now. Day at a time, step at a time. Don't worry. Don't worry. Or I'll never get thin. You're not going to get thin today. You weigh 7,000 pounds. You can eat less today and you'll probably weigh less tomorrow. It's a day at a time. It's a step at a time. There's nowhere else to go. If there were a better place to go, I heard this recently. It's so not necessary. But I went to Weight Watchers once. I went many times, but I went to Weight Watchers once. And you know what happened, Lonnie? In 2 weeks, I lost 14 days. I don't know why I said that. But this program, if you're new, really does have all the answers. By the way, a career, a marriage, a body that's virtually the same year in, year out now. And that's all because if I stay focused and I stay in the day, when the challenges of the day go up, as Don P would say, you can't stay clean today on yesterday's shower. So if the ante gets upped, the challenge gets bigger. And you know what? So what? You want to know what's supposed to happen in your day any given day? Bobby Earl says, get up, get dressed, go outside and see what happens. I welcome you guys to do that. And thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Jack. All right, that means it's my turn. Hi, everybody. I'm Aaron. I'm a compulsive overeater and a 100-pounder. And I don't know if it's embarrassed or humble, but I'm right now speaking to a room full of people who gave me this program. So it's an honor and a privilege to be sitting here as one of the speakers because most of the people in the audience are the people that I will be stealing from throughout the rest of this share, the words of wisdom and the advice and the love and the support I've got, including the man who sponsored me when I came in. So to qualify, I am a 100-pounder, and I don't know if that's – I guess the definition is somebody who ever has had or has the burden of 100 pounds to lose. My top weight loss in program is 116 pounds. As of my last weigh-in, my current weight loss is around 94 pounds. So I have found about 20 of the pounds that I lost. They weren't difficult to find. They were just lying right there on top. And I don't know why is the thing that keeps coming up to me. My food has not changed much. But we'll get to that, I guess, a little bit later on. I've been coming to programs since 2011. I remember coming in the fall, and I remember specifically not going to the first Thanksgiving in the Park that I was invited to because I couldn't see how I would feel comfortable overeating at Thanksgiving if I went to a meeting like that first thing in the morning. And I remember that was the start of kind of the last binge period. I went through another Thanksgiving. I went through another Halloween and Christmas and New Year's time, and it was coming around New Year's, and I was just still miserable. I don't know about the rest of you, but one of the reasons I came into program is because the food stopped working. If the food still worked, I would still be working the food program. I would still be working the large meals and the binges and the exercising it off and everything else. Really what happened was it stopped working, and I had to go find something else. My top weight is over 300 pounds. 300 pounds was always my own personal ceiling. If I saw 3 on the scale, that was a sign that I had to stop having fun and do whatever I could to beat that number back down. And as soon as I was any distance under 300 pounds, it was, oh, okay, then I know I can do it if I ever really want to get thin. I could go back to doing whatever I wanted. But that was where I got kind of my control fix. When I wasn't getting my control fix by having what is quite honestly the only like drug that will stay legal forever. I don't know how many people know this about compulsive overeaters, but we are the ultimate control freaks. We picked the drug you cannot take away from us. It's like you cannot tell me not to eat. And we're very good. We have a good PR system out in the world that's also saying, and by the way, stop talking to us about our bodies too. Just don't talk to us about it. That's the current kind of out in the media, out in the public. It's becoming just, people look like what they look like and shut the hell up about it. Which is interesting because it's true. And yet I know that I was miserable when I was heavy. I was not miserable because I was heavy. I was already miserable. The weight was just a symptom of the fact that I refused to take care of my life. Every time I had an uncomfortable emotion, it was called hunger. Every time I had something that I didn't want to deal with, it was called, I should really go to a gym. I shouldn't deal with the people in my life. I shouldn't make amends for things that I've done wrong. I shouldn't look at myself and see if there's something better that I want to do with my life. I should make myself look like people on magazines, TVs, and movies, and then everything would be perfect, which, you know, we call judging my insides by everybody else's outsides. What brought me into program, I'll tell the story shortly because I've told it a lot and I'm kind of tired of it, but it is my story, and I'm a big believer in the fact that God gave me this story for a reason. This is the testimony that I have to offer, and all I can ever do is be honest with all of you the same way you are with me. So my story was, my mom also died what I thought was young. My mom died when I was 23, and I felt like a complete outsider. I remember it kind of started because my parents started having financial troubles when I was in high school. And I remember by the time I was a senior in high school, I no longer wanted to talk about my family because, my parents had to declare bankruptcy. My dad was out of work. My mom had, flunked out of an attempt at law school. And I just felt like I didn't want to talk about where I came from. I would talk to anybody about my big plans, my big dreams, how I was going to, you know, rocket to success and stardom. But I didn't want to take people home after a certain point. And I was carrying that shame around with me. By the time I was 30, my mother had passed when I was 23. My father had passed away. I found that I didn't have the success and stardom that I was after. I was struggling to find work. I didn't have any meaningful relationships. I had friends that I saw every once in a while, but I didn't meet with them on a weekly basis. I didn't hang out with anybody. I was looking for work in the entertainment industry. That was my focus. Anything involved with entertainment was what I was going to go do. Trying to escape another career that was more lucrative, but I felt was soul-crushing. And the opportunity came up to become a stagehand for a traveling circus. And I immediately submitted an application and then said, it's not going to happen. I'm not going to go. Nothing cool ever happens to me. And in talking about it with the friends and family that I had, the phrase that came up was, you know what? You got no kids. You got no wife. You got no job. You got no connections. If you can't run away with the circus, who the hell can? So I did. I went and traveled around with the circus for a year. It didn't, it was an amazing adventure. I would highly recommend it to anybody who's got the backbone for it. It is grueling. It is the ultimate geographic. It is, a backbreaking work. I would work a typical weekend at the circus. You start working at 9 a.m. on, or sorry, at 8 a.m. on Friday morning, and you finish working at 6 a.m. on Monday morning. And you are at work consistently except for the 7 hours you have off to sleep each night. And that's it. And, you know, Sunday you start at 8 a.m. and you finish 6 a.m. Monday morning without stopping. If at the end of one of these weekends you decide you're going to sit down and eat 10,000 calories, there is no living creature on earth that will tell you you have not earned it. So I got to lose weight and binge at the same time. It was a miracle. I loved it. I got to sit there and compete with people. What are you going to have? I'm going to have 6 cheeseburgers. Well, I'm going to have 12. I mean, we would just, it was what we did. Last legal drug. At the end of that year, because I was doing anything except paying attention to my life and my own behaviors, a woman that I had dated called me up to say that she was pregnant and that I was the only possible father. I thought that was a wake-up call from God. So I left the circus. I came back, went back to the soul-crushing career because it makes me a lot of money. Started raising a child with this woman. And I don't know how many of you have ever done it. Oh, wait. I don't know how many of you have done it, but raising a kid is hard work. And it's hard when you're doing it with someone who you are absolutely madly in love with. It's damn near impossible when you're doing it with someone you can barely stand. There's just too much of having to deal with somebody else. So the fights started, and she eventually announced that she wanted to take her baby and go back to live with her family, who were across the country. And me and my family said, well, that's our baby. And we started doing all the things that we thought we would have to do to fight to keep custody, including getting a DNA test, because we were going to go into a court and say, here's me on the birth certificate, here's the DNA test, here's all the child support I paid, that's my kid, and I want full custody. But when the DNA test came back, the child was not mine. That was the real wake-up call. I admire God's patience in laying that one out for me, because it didn't look like it looks on TV and movies. What really brought it home to me were two things. One, when you sit there and you hold a small child in your hands, you actually find out how mature you feel. And what I felt when I looked at that small kid was, I can get you to high school, but after that, I have no idea what you're supposed to do with your life. There was a certain level of adultness I felt I didn't have. And the second thing was when I found out that this woman had been lying to me. And once you find out about one lie, once you know something's a lie, all the other lies become so clear and you realize that you've just been gaslit the whole time. And I thought, what have I been doing that I can't tell somebody is sitting right here in front of me lying to me like this all the time? You know? I mean, if I were doing drugs constantly, I'd understand it. But how could I be that checked out of my own life? And so I had a therapist at the time, and we started talking, and I said to her, I don't trust my own brain. Like, I don't trust anything I'm even thinking right now. I don't even know how to go about living my life. I don't know what you do if you don't trust your own head. And she was a 12-stepper, and she said, I do. And we started talking about which group I might want to go to. And if you've been listening to the story, I qualified for quite a few of these groups. But when I went looking for a 12-step meeting, I was at midnight. I was lying in bed. I was going through these websites, looking at all the meetings in my area. There was an OA meeting 2 blocks away from my house at 9 a.m. the next morning. So I said to myself, okay, I will go take care of the wait at the same time. But I came into these rooms looking for sanity and looking for God, and I think that was a huge blessing. You know, they talk about the gift of desperation. I didn't care what I looked like. It's nice. I like the physical recovery that I've gotten in this program. It is a wonderful and fun thing to be young and active and healthy. Thank you. But that's not the gift of the program. And I'm saying that from a position of the weight's creeping back up without me having changed my food. I ran 26.2 miles this last Sunday at a marathon that I flew to Florida to run in. And I weighed in on Wednesday, and I am up 2 pounds. And I'm looking at God going, I just ran 26.2 miles. You can't get me this way in? What is this? Come on. But when I started my absence, I have to tell this story because my sponsor's in the room, and this is a Half Measures workshop. And this is kind of where Half Measures starts for me. My therapist said, why don't you download one of these apps from the store and start tracking your food? And every single one of these apps, I've never seen one that will let you just enter what you ate. They all want you to know how many calories or points or whatever that food constitutes. So I called my sponsor all happy, proud about it. And I said, well, I'm tracking because my therapist tells me to track. And he says, and I said, and the cool thing is, you know, I can do it so that I can still get that heavy dinner, right? Like, if you tell me I have 2,000 calories a day, 1,500 of them are going to be dinner. I can wait. It's fine. I will save up for my mini binge somehow. And he said, why don't you just write it down on a piece of paper? What's the point of that? That's not fun. Says, just write down what you're eating and send it to me. We're not going to track. We're not going to do math around this. And we talked about this for about a week. And he said, look, it's not that you're being crazy by entering this stuff, and it's not that you are, you know, doing something that is in itself gonna, you know, ruin your life, but at this point, you're still controlling what you eat, and that's dancing at the water's edge. If you're gonna, you know, I worked the steps. We're at step 3. I've turned my will and my life over to a power greater than myself. Because if you've turned it over, you have to turn it over, and you have to trust the advice that God is giving you. And the advice that was coming to me then was stop counting the calories, stop counting the points, just write it down, send it in, and we'll talk about it if it looks like it's an issue. So I decided, like the big book says, we're at the jumping off point, and this was it for me. Okay, I'll try it his way for a little bit. And I told my therapist, who costs a lot more than my sponsor, that I was going to take my sponsor's direction, and she said, fine, because she was a 12-stepper. And following that advice and never having written down a single calorie for anything that I've eaten, I lost 116 pounds. And I went from somebody who wouldn't get off the couch to go around to the corner to the store to someone who's running marathons all over the country. And that comes from turning it over. And I don't know that I could tell you why it works. And I don't know that I want to be able to tell you why it works. I'm a very heady guy. I'm a very smart guy. In my disease, I made tons of spreadsheets. I loved to find the actual specific scientific calculations that PhDs and doctors used to tell you how many calories you're supposed to have every single day. I loved that because that put me in control. But for me, this program has been about letting go and letting God. And I wear a little bracelet on my wrist that I have to explain to anybody who meets me or gets to know me. And it usually is a window into talking about the 12 steps. But I turn it over because my will, doing what I did, my broken brain all by itself, ends me up 300 pounds raising a kid that isn't mine, in a career I don't want to be in, not paying any attention to my life, just shoveling food into my mouth, dreaming about when I will finally be able to fall into unconsciousness and dreading waking up again. I read a book that looked at several different addicts, just wrote descriptions of people who were gamblers and shoplifters and sex addicts and alcoholics, just to see, you know, descriptions to see what was similar between them. And there was one thing that was common to every single overeater, every single food addict. They all believed that if they woke up tomorrow in the body of their dreams, they could keep it without changing anything they were doing. They all believed that at some point in the past they had been doing something to gain weight, and now they were just stuck there, even though all of their behaviors were now perfectly healthy and justified. And I totally identified with that. I dreamed of being able to wake up tomorrow completely thin with a hunky body and continue to eat everything I'd ever wanted and never exercise at all. And when I realized that was the problem. I wanted different results from the same actions over and over and over again. I honestly was just checked out. I just wanted what I wanted. I didn't want to work for it. I didn't want to change anything. I have sponsees now, and when we have conversations, I tell them, you know, all the only answer I can ever, ever, ever give you is the answer to the question, what did I do in recovery? What did I do to recover? If you come to me and you want to talk about bulimia, I have love and sympathy, and I will support you. I never had bulimia. You're going to have to go find someone else in the room who actually recovered from it. You come to me with exercise addiction. I have a very healthy relationship with exercise. I pick a marathon. I pick a marathon plan. I do what the schedule tells me. When the schedule says I get to stop, I stop. I do not run a single minute longer than any of my schedules has ever made me run in order to keep up with the schedule. I'm not addicted to exercise. I enjoy it. It's a wonderful meditation, but I have yet to say, you know what, it's 11 o'clock at night and I'm feeling uncomfortable. I'm going to go for a 30-mile run. Not going to happen. But I'm there for them. I'll take the call and I'll say, hey, I know this guy has shared about that in meetings. I know this woman has it. We'll maybe call her. But that's the only thing any of us can do, is testify to what we have actually seen work. None of us are geniuses. None of us are PhDs. In the big book, Bill talks about, you know, actually it's one of our traditions. We're not professionals at this. It's an avocation. It's we got it, so we share it. And by the way, we don't share it because we're smarter than anybody. We don't share it because we're more spiritual. None of us are the Pope. We share it because sharing it is what keeps us sane and healthy. You know, it's how we work our program. So, that must be the most intelligent thing I've said, because now my brain just stopped. I've always been like a dive head first guy into program. My sponsor's instructions to me were to read the big book every day. He told me how to work the steps, and he said, call me every once in a while and let me know how you're doing. And I called him every single day before 9 a.m. And God bless him, he listened to all those messages, and he took the call. And the reason was because I needed it. I wanted the discipline, so I went and got the discipline. I made myself do it. I liked when people share in the room that their sponsor was making them share or making them call. There are people who say, you know, oh, my sponsor made me call before 6 a.m. I'm like, oh, I love those sponsors. I want a demanding sponsor who just tells me everything that I have to do, and then I can dive head first, and I've got the schedule, and I know what's going on, because I'm a control freak. If you're new and you're struggling, the only advice I have, I mean, actually, this is what I wanted to say when I was thinking ahead to the share I was going to give. It might shock people in this room, but I'm going to be the person to tell you, as far as I believe, you cannot do this wrong. Another speaker shared, you can't get in trouble anymore, guys. When my sponsees call me and they say, well, I ate one of the foods that's on my red light list, I say, okay, before you did that, did you call somebody? No, I didn't call. Okay, well, next time we're going to call. You're not in trouble. I'm not putting you in OA jail. What happened was you experienced a symptom, which was a craving, and there's medicine to take for that, just like taking an aspirin for a headache. You had a symptom, and one of the options was to make a call. Next time they'll call, they say, well, I called a bunch of people, but nobody picked up. I said, well, did you try writing? And they say, no, I didn't try writing. Okay, well, next time after you call people, maybe try writing. There's 12 of them. I don't know anybody who can make it through all. I don't know anyone who has ever told me they worked all 9 tools and they didn't work. And I don't know anybody who, like, would get to all 9 tools and still be craving. Most people I know would be like, this is too much. I'm just not even going to entertain this anymore. It's too much work to be triggered right now. I'm just going to go do something else. Or hell, by the time I work, I mean, I eat every 4 hours, so by the time I've worked all 9 tools, it's probably mealtime anyway. So, for me, it's a big deal, you know, God in this program, the God this program gave me and asked me to create. I got to step 2 and it said you just had to believe in a power greater than yourself. And if you read the OA 12 and 12, it actually gets real particular. It says you just have to be willing to act as if there's a power greater than yourself. So my actual second step reads, I have the willingness to act as if the God that I need is here for me. The God that I want, like I just said in the share several seconds ago, is a God who says, here's what you have to do. Here are the rules. These are what you will follow. And there are great consequences if you don't. The God that I need is the one who says, hey, it's a nice day outside tomorrow. There's a couple million people that you have a chance to meet. I want to see you go have, there's a couple million things that you can do. I want to see you go have some fun. I want to see you laugh. I want to see you talk to some pretty girls. I want to see you enjoy their company and let them enjoy you. I want to see you, you know, enjoy work. I want to see you do a little bit of writing, a little bit of praying, a little bit of meditating. And I want to see you, you know, get to bed, do your 10th step and write down a bunch of things you're grateful for because it's been a big, full, exciting day. That's what my God that I need wants for me. He never wants to see me suffer. He never wants to see me, you know, crying on the floor. Thank you. He just wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And if I'm that kind of light in the world, other people around me start to be able to feel happy, joyous, and free. And the weight's going to take care of itself. Right now, I can run a marathon faster than the last marathon I ran. Now, I only beat my time by about 30 seconds, and I'm whining about that in every single meeting I go to because I feel like I worked hard and I should have gotten a better improvement. But the fact of the matter is, right now in my life, I'm dating a beautiful woman. I'm enjoying my job. I'm working towards getting into the career that I've always wanted to get into, which is being a creative writer. I am able to come and spend a whole weekend of recovery with all these beautiful fellows. Every person in this place is happy to talk to me. I can have so many fun conversations and laughs and jokes. My marathon times are improving. Everything in my life, by every possible measure, is going well. But there is this number that I have to look at every 30 days that keeps creeping up. And if I'm in my will, I will look at that number and I will say, I'm not allowed to feel good about anything going on in my life because that number says I'm doing it wrong. Except I can't do it wrong. I didn't come to this program to do things right. I came to this program because I needed a connection with something greater than myself because trying to do it on my own didn't work and my life was miserable. And literally it was when I walked in these rooms, if OA doesn't work, I'm leaving the planet. I couldn't figure out what life itself was for until I came to this program. So when I'm struggling with the idea of, am I doing half measures? For me, the answer has never been to double down or get harder on myself. For me, the answer has always been to find some quiet permission to do something that makes me uncomfortable, but has the virtue of being something I've never tried before, which means I know it's not going to leave me in the exact same place I'm already at. If I want to get someplace new, I have to do something new. I have to try something new. And I have to give myself permission to be uncomfortable and whiny and kind of annoying to the people that take my outreach calls while I try it out. But I got to give it an honest try. So that's it. Thank you very much for letting me share.
Yes, I'm going to stand up. Is that okay? I'm not going to walk the room. Just stand up. I'm Sherry. I'm a compulsive overeater.
Hi, Sherry.
And, well, just to qualify really quickly, I came into program March of 2005 at, the last known weight was 292 pounds. I was a size 28, couldn't walk, had a hard time breathing. And, I currently have 3 years and 2 months out of, my third relapse. So I have relapses, not just one in my story. And I, weigh in the mid 130s today. And, it's the first time that I've maintained my weight in my life. And it's really interesting because, you know, I thought a lot about this half measures. And I never went half measures with food. Somebody was talking to me, you know, yesterday about that. I went with full gusto. And it wasn't a couple, you know, bites of something. It was just like, let me inhale it. But going back a little bit, you know, I was a woman of extremes. I was on, off. If I couldn't do it all, forget it. I didn't do anything. And, you know, black, white. And so it was a lot of crash and burn. So I would, like, you know, put all my effort into it and then burn. And then what did I need? I needed my food. I didn't understand growing up because I wasn't really an overweight. I wasn't a fat kid. I was plump, chubby. You have such a pretty face. If only you couldn't just lose the weight. And my weight in a lovely Jewish family was the focus of everybody's business. And it was, you know, I was the only girl. I had a skinny brother. He ate the chocolate. I had the apple. And my resentment started young. And my grandmother, she lived 101, good Russian stock, and started when I was 16, probably even earlier, she said, you're going on a diet. So starting from 16, and even when I came into OA, I came in right before my 40th birthday. I was always on some kind of diet, some kind of, this is the answer, this is the time, this is why. Now I have this, now I have that. I was the self-help guru. I have so many books on my shelves that have not been read. They just looked good in the bookstore. I was like, oh, that looks like a great cover. Never opened it. But you know what? Maybe by osmosis, I might get it. I had 15 years of therapy. Ooh, I know why I ate. It didn't help me to stop. And I only knew I went on commercial diets and acupuncture and, you know, emotional eating, recovery group, blah, 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 because I told you I had a food problem. It's just a little problem. You know, I don't eat that much. I just eat the wrong thing. And I remember when I first came into OA, my first sponsor said, yeah, just write your food down and send it to me. I said, horrible. Send you my food? Oh, my God. But you know what? My biggest character defect is people-pleasing. I was like, okay, sure. But it actually worked in my favor. And I was like, I don't want to have to send what I ate. You know, really, you know, I couldn't lie. I don't know why. I could have, I guess, but I just didn't. So I was like, I guess I'm not going to eat that. But I think I gained weight in the beginning of OA because I was flipped out that somebody, even though I could go on a diet, nobody was really telling me, you need to do this. I was like, oh, my God, you're telling me, you know, 3 meals, 2 snacks? I ate all day. I ate sweet. My biggest binge food was birthday cake, and it had to be very specific. You know, my food was about, it was reacting to life, reacting to my emotion. So if I was sad, I needed comfort. It was something creamy and sweet and smooth. If I was angry, it was something crunchy and you know, and I was like, I would eat with a vengeance and say, I hope you die. I'll take my poison. And what's happening? Nothing's happening out here. I'm the one that's getting hurt. But all along, I kept thinking, I'm just trying to use food to comfort me. Even in OA, and people said, you're hurting yourself. I'm like, no, I'm trying to comfort. I'm trying to live. I'm trying to breathe because food was my everything. But growing up, you know, there was no abuse. There was none of that. But it was a lot of, you know, that Jewish guilt. My mother just gave me a look. It was not yelling at me. And it was like, oh, my God, let me cower in the corner. And it just wasn't safe for me to express myself. My dad was, you know, desensitize yourself, you know, grow a thick skin. And because he was sensitive, he couldn't deal with it himself. He didn't want his children to be like that. You know, I grew up hearing impaired. My dad is deaf, and we never talked about it. This big white elephant in the room. And I was, you know, singled out from classrooms. I had to be moved because I couldn't understand the teacher. All of these things that I just wanted to fit in, and I just didn't. And all I knew as a child was that food made me feel better, period. And in the big book, it says we like the effects produced by whatever substance we pick up. My thing is food. My thing is the sweeter, the better. There could be nothing sweet enough. And if there wasn't the right cake in the store, I went for the canned icing. And it's a progressive disease. And I was a yo-yo dieter, so I started gaining and losing 10 to 20 pounds. And before OA, I was gaining and losing 80, 90 pounds. Unfortunately, when I first came into OA, I thought, this is something else to try. I didn't understand the God thing. I didn't understand, you know, what are these thin people in? Why are they holding my hand? Why do they want my name? Why do they want my phone number? Back off. Get away, people. Nobody coming between me and my food. You know, it's a very private affair. And I had a leopard print recliner that I practically lived in. And I couldn't be bothered walking from the recliner in the living room to my kitchen, so I would put out kind of what I call my food blanket. And I would sit and eat, recline, sleep, sit and eat. Oh, I'm sorry. And the TV. The TV was part of it, too. And I thought I was fine. And I would put, you know, I would eat in private and out there. My mother, even to this day, is like, I don't understand why you got up to that weight. That was ridiculous. As if I had a choice. I'm like, you'll never understand. I don't need to make them understand. They still don't understand. And I guess, you know, because I kept changing diets. And why couldn't they keep up with the program? And my brother just recently we were at the same park. We did the half marathon. And he said, I thought you ate six small meals. And they don't, I must have confused the hell out of them. And I, you know, why can't you keep up with what I'm doing? I'm like, no. So, you know, today I do three meals, a snack, and I can't have any sweets. This is what, I can't do sugar-free, agave, fruit juice, sweetened. If it tastes sweet, forget it. I cannot have one. I can have a box, I can have a sheet, but I can't have a serving. And, you know, so I first came into OA. I thought, oh, this is something else I'll try. This is pretty social. You know what? Someone said hello to me after the first meeting. They were nice. I didn't understand. I didn't have any exposure to 12-step program. Even though we were, you know, we were Jewish, my dad said, if God is everywhere, you can pray at home. We never prayed. So I did not believe in God. But how do I bring something that I can see, feel, hear, touch, smell into my everyday life? I didn't understand that. And unfortunately, this is a spiritual program. It's not a food program. And so when I came in, okay, again, the black and white, let's go through that checklist. I'm a very good student. I have 3 degrees. I know. I have a head full of knowledge. I check, you know, work the steps. Yep, check. Lost 100 pounds the first year. Check. Service, check, 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 check. I was doing it all. But it was that physical part of the stool and the emotions. Oh, my goodness. You know, I'm not good with that, but I let them come up. And emotions have a beginning, middle, and end as well. They come and they go and they come and they go. And I started to flex that discomfort muscle. But that spiritual leg of the stool, what do you mean turn my life and will over to the care of God as I understood him? I didn't understand him. I was like, yeah, you know, going through the motion. So at 21 months, I started slipping. And the slips I did, I would gain and lose 5 to 8 pounds overnight. That's a slip. And it started, you know, when I was cooking for my snacks, it was not really quite a snack, that I had to restart my abstinence. And then it was, again, that stop and go, you know, start and go. I didn't realize what a gift a day can be. Because I always, you know, on or off. I had to get back into the box. I had to get into my structured food plan and eat rabbit food. Or I was going to go way off. It took me 4 years to get another one-year candle. And I'm on my 7th sponsor. I react. And one time I relapsed because my sponsor had said, well, I think you're not abstinent anymore. And I'm like, you know what? I'll show you I'm not abstinent anymore. And guess what? I ran out and I had sugar. Who did that hurt? I'm like, okay. And every relapse, I never left the rooms, but I would gain, again, it started with 40, 50 pounds. This last relapse, I gained 110 pounds in 11 months, 40 of it in 1 month. I know how to F and eat. And I know how to lose weight. So for me, it's not about the black and white. What does it mean to be in the gray? And the gray can be a very murky, you know, mucky 50 shades of gray, you know. And it's been a challenge because I am a very control, black and white, numbers calm me, okay? When I'm feeling, like, really emotional, I do spreadsheets, okay? It's a little nut. But it's something about shifting from these nebulous feelings. I'm a web developer. I'm a programmer. It either works or it doesn't. I used to be a designer, and there were too many variables, and this one doesn't like that. I don't know what I want. And I said, forget it. I don't like it. I needed something concrete. So it has been a lesson for me to be the first year in maintenance, and I have gone through a lot of changes, grief, loss, and I'm like, wow. I'm still abstinent. That's not to say I don't sometimes use food. Even in abstinent, I love my food. It takes the edge off. We're human. And so, you know, and also I was talking to Aaron earlier about what half measures, how it appears in the big book. It talks about the spiritual part. It's in chapter 5, step 3, before the listing of all the steps. The relapses always started in my mind way before my hand was in the box of something, or, you know, my mouth went to the food. And it was a thought that went unwritten. it was thought that went unshared. It were, you know, that we're sick as our secrets. And it was, I'm going to do this anyway. Nobody will know. And it was, I'm not going to go to the meeting tonight because I have XYZ to do. I'm too tired. I don't want to. I have the big case that I don't want it. I'm not a woman of routine. Every night I'm like, I don't want, it's like a little child. I don't want to. I don't feel like it. I can't give my mind an inch because it will grab me by the throat. I have to do it anyway. And, you know, they talk about an AA smart feet. Like, you just get to your meeting. You just get to the writing. You just, you know, my sponsor sometimes will be like, write and call me back. She did, she has 35 sponsees. She's AAOA. We don't have time to chit-chat. So call with your writing and get to business. And I appreciate that because it gets right. And she doesn't want to talk about the food. This is the life program. I have a problem with life. And underneath the food, I have a problem with people and relationship. And I'm not even talking about, you know, the romantic kind, the family. I moved 3,000 miles away, and it still took work to separate. And now I would even consider going back. Because I remember distinctly, because of this program, that I was visiting at Thanksgiving, and I saw my parents, and it was like the veil, because I had such anger and rage. You know, and I would tell you, at, you know, at my first fourth step, I'm not an angry person. I'm very nice. 240 names and resentment later. And my pencil ripping through the paper showed a lot of hidden rage. It wasn't just a little bit annoyance or anger. But I remember when I went back to visit one time, it was like the veil and the anger just fell away. And I just saw them as people with their own hopes, dreams, faults, frailty. They did not know what to do with an almost 300-pound daughter. Wow. And now they haven't changed. I mean, because if it's not about my weight, they're like, are you going to comb your hair today? Or are you going to, you know, there's always something. And I just laugh. And the other, you know, just... I went back for Thanksgiving. I had my hair up, and my mom said, I don't like your hair up like that. And I said, oh, well. What can I say? And I used to, the biggest sin for me was to disappoint my mother. So for me to, and you know, my brother said something, God, you're snapping at each other at the first time. And I'm speaking up. I'm 50 years old, going on a teenager, learning how to speak up. Because I have squashed my voice and my feeling all my life. And it is not easy. I mean, I had to do a lot of writing and talking to my sponsor to have a conversation with a friend that I felt we were growing apart, and it hurt. And my sponsor keeps telling me, you get to have your feelings. You don't have to act on them. And that's new for me. It's new for me to feel my feeling and be okay. They're just feeling. You know, I get tripped up sometimes by the happy, joyous, and free, thinking I have to be happy all the time. I did that. I tried to be happy, wear a smile. Sometimes I just don't want to. That's okay, because I want to be free. So going back to the half measures, you know, in the big book, so it talks about the spiritual part. I had to act as if. I have these conversations in my head, and I hear voices in response. Let's hope that, you know, no schizophrenia might, you know. But I'm like, who's talking back to me in this maternal voice? It's got, you know, and it talks in the big book, the great reality is found deep within. And I had to sit quietly because I had spent all my life running, being busy, got to be busy, got to be with people. And to sit with myself, not isolate, but to sit. And sometimes I have to hug myself and stroke myself and hold my hand, say, it's going to be okay. You have everything you need. That is the part that was missing before. Because in the relapse, it was I had no coping skills. This is, we have a spiritual toolkit, and sometimes I can do it like an action plan. Yeah, but I have to bring it from my head to my heart, to my body. Sometimes it's just me sitting outside and looking at my lemon tree. And everybody's path is different. This is my story, and it's been more about going within. sitting with myself, writing my feeling, sharing it. I don't want to share it. I want this to be a self-help, self-paced program. I'm going to do it home. I work out of my house. I mean, it really takes me an effort to be among the people, to form relationships even when they hurt, even when they go. Because we are social creatures. And if I don't have my food, I need to pick up something else. And that something else, whether it's the tools, but it's the spiritual. So the God of my understanding is like this wise, sage woman, maternal, because I seem to have a need for that. I sit on the floor, lean against the wall, feel the support. I can't fall through the floor. I can't fall. It's like, I got you. I got you. So when things come up, they focus in the day. Sometimes I have to get very microscopic. What the next thing I need to do? Take out the garbage. Do some prayer. So I say the Serenity Prayer constantly. Some feelings will flare up, and I need to deal with it in that moment. I cannot afford to let it fester. Even when someone has wronged me or I'm justified, they don't know. I'm the one that's affected. I can't afford to carry it. So I need to practice turning over. And sometimes, you know, I've had some financial fears, and to the point I can't breathe. I can't continue not breathing. I'm like, God, you have got to take this away. And so with that, thank you for letting me share.
Awesome. Okay. Now is the time for questions and answers. Please raise your hand and I will call on as many questioners as possible. Your questions can be directed at one person specifically or generally for the panel to answer. Please be aware that we are recording this panel, and when asking a question, your voice may be audible on the recording. Who would like to ask the first question? So the question is, for everyone on the panel who's had relapse, when you look back, what was the first thing that changed to signal the relapse was beginning?
The first, I have not relapsed with the food, per se. That said, I was struck by something in the literature that Sherry alluded to about, by the time the alcoholic has the drink in his hand, he's going to drink. It's been a whole succession of things he ought not have been doing that he was, and or a whole long succession of things he should have been doing that he wasn't. That the drink is just not the first step of a problem. It's the last step of a problem. And that's, whether it's superstition or not, it's respect for that reality that keeps me as much on the straight and narrow as I possibly can. So the variable will be different, but I started getting sloppy yesterday. I was aware that there were three calls I had not returned. One, a program call. Actually, a second one with a guy a newcomer I had just met in a meeting. And an old friend who I hadn't followed up on, and I felt badly about not being a conscientious participant. I've been doing a lot of I've got some things going on in my life between I lost most of last year to a physical malady. I had a arm problem and then surgery. Our dog's been really sick at various times in the last year. And I realized I was getting sloppy, and I began to get scared that that's real easy for me to do. And I was home yesterday afternoon resting, and I picked up the phone. And as much as I didn't want to, I returned all three calls, apologized to the extent that I had been less than, by my standards, prompt. And I'm only talking being 3 days, 4 days, 2 days, but not the kind of response I would have liked to have given, especially to the newcomer. And I felt so different after that was over. There's no I won't buy insurance. It doesn't buy me any insurance. It doesn't guarantee me a goddamn thing. But it increases the likelihood that as I know there's something I need to do, as I wake up and I see something in front of me that must be done, I can no longer just rationalize it and say, if I haven't called back in 3 days, I can wait one more. I had the time. I have the awareness. I was conscious of it. And I had no choice. And I felt better. Will that buy me another day in the paradise, in the kingdom? You know what? I choose to believe it will. So when I see it, I got to do it. When I see it, I got to come clean with it, own it. And if illuminated by a fellow that there's things I ought to be taken, I can't minimize the truth of that. That's just for me.
I just wanted to say, I never intended to relapse. It usually doesn't happen with that intention. I'm going out, but it starts with the behaviors. And I agree with Jack when the biggest reason why I want to eat, I'm uncomfortable. And I have things to do that I haven't done. And all the time that I think about, I should be doing this, it would have been easier just to do that thing. So I really, that's what I meant. I can't give a lot of room in my mind to go rain free. So I do that very next thing, the very next thing, the very next thing. And compassion for myself that I've had to learn. You know what? It didn't get done today, tomorrow.
I don't know if I should speak on that. I not relapsed with the food. The only experience I can share is I have relapsed in other programs that I'm in. OA is kind of my nice one. It's my first one. It's the last one I'll give up. Usually the two things that I noticed that preceded are one, I've stopped doing my nightly or morning spiritual practices. Like the days that I relapse, I'm like, oh, it's been like 4 days since I've done my prayers in the morning and I've sat down and done my writing, my step work and so on. And the only other thing I notice is that, I'll usually start building up to my relapses by, I start making lists in my head of all the things that I've done that I think I'm owed for. I just start sitting there going, you know what? I did that run and I helped out that person. I start making the list instead of saying, wow, I'm grateful for these things I've gotten to do. I start making the list like, what can I cash that in for? And so that's one of the behaviors I kind of watch out for. Next question.
So I go inside like you do. I hug myself. And for 4 weeks, I sort of let that go. I just laid in bed and prayed. You know, and I really related to what you said. Because I hug myself, I do that. But for those 4 weeks, I sort of did it. It was really weird. Because now I get it, or I do. That helps me. So when I go to say that, that's how I do that. Hug myself, talk to God, do that.
Roz, is what's the question?
The question is, do you do that every day? How do you do that? How do you go inside?
How do I go inside myself every day? So, when you're with yourself, you are with yourself. And I'm not a person of routine. So when the need calls for it, I will, sometimes just to sit outside with myself or to look at the mirror at myself. I guess I'm not making a very clear answer. Sometimes it takes talking to others, and then sometimes it takes being with myself. Sometimes I'll listen to a podcast because I do think we can't work this. If it were simple of me going inside and working a therapist, but that's not the only thing. I have just found that that has helped in my process, but I need to combine it with, if I can't get out of the house, I get on phone meetings, I listen to podcasts, and I'll make calls.
You write.
Make calls?
You write.
I do write. Yeah.
Yes. So can someone talk about the getting from I'm saying the right things, I'm saying program, but I'm not feeling program, I'm not connecting with it?
You know, it talks about having worked these steps, we have this spiritual awakening. So it's an action of doing the steps. So step 3 is is reinforced by 4 through 9 and then the maintenance step. So I know that I need to keep doing the work. My life take care of itself. There's a saying that I've heard in the room, if you polish over here, if you wax over here, it will shine over there. So all I know to do, whenever I'm struggling through something or not feeling connected, all I know to do are the tools and the steps. That's it. When I'm struggling with the food, when I'm struggling with life, with emotions, and it threatened to overpower me, that's what I mean about the very next indicated action. And that might be writing. It doesn't come right away. We're not very patient people. And sometimes I just need to wait. But it comes, and it doesn't come and stay. For me, it comes and goes. It comes and goes. And I think that was a misnomer for me. Like I said, that happy, joyous, and free, and I'm going to be on a mountaintop. And, no, it doesn't happen like that. But I have to, and gratitude. Really taking a step back and go, oh, you know what? I'm okay right now in this moment. I have everything I need. There's no want. So I have to bring myself back to the present.
I want to share because what resonates for me when you ask the question is I've had this experience of going to a meeting and in the share having the intention of, okay, I'm going to give a good OA share. I want to share recovery and I want to share strength. And I give I feel like I give a share that's like, I'm finding the gratitude. I'm finding the good side. I'm listening for God. And I leave the meeting feeling more triggered, more cravings, worse than when I went in, and thinking, well, that meeting didn't work. bedrock of this program is honesty. You know, there are those with mental and emotional difficulties, and they do recover if they have the capacity to be honest with themselves. I've found that the template for the 3-minute share is 1 minute on the problem, 2 minutes on the solution. Give yourself that minute on the problem. Connect with it. Your feeling. One of my touchstones is the phrase, my feelings have a right to this body too. Not just my thoughts. When I'm angry, I have a right to feel the anger. And once I've done that, say, now let's look at what that anger's about. But I have a right to spend a minute feeling exactly my all natural emotions, connecting with them, identifying them. Sometimes I'm really, really, really pissed off at a pet peeve, and sometimes I am deeply enraged because somebody has done something that threatens something very, very important. It's important to know which one of those angers I'm dealing with, because my disease tells me that any anger is all the same anger and it's all the same solution. I got one end game, which is to eat. And in recovery, I get to really identify and name my feelings. But in order for that to happen, I got to give myself that minute to connect with it. So I get to do in my shares, I get to be the defect for a second. I'm really pissed off. I want to kill this person. I want to key their car. I want to break into their house and, you know, smash something that they like. And then I get to say, but I'm not doing that because I have better solutions than that. But I get to connect with it. So usually if I skip the part where I'm actually being honest with myself about how I'm feeling, I find it's harder to see the value in program.
Aaron's a lot healthier than I am. No. What I say is, just for today, I won't smash their car. Just for today. I mean, no promises about tomorrow. Two things come to mind. First of all, is often I reread the spiritual experience, because they talk about, though the lightning bolt variety does happen, thank God for most of us that more of our experiences are of the educational variety slowly over time, and that we ourselves might not even be aware of it, but it will manifest. So we get the daily reprieve predicated upon keeping a fit spiritual condition. If I do the do and let go of the results, which is the height to me of the third step, but also there's a religious, musical, spiritual text of a non-denominational, something I won't mention because it's an outside issue, but there is a writing, or I think it's a writing, and the paraphrase quote is, on thy action be thy focus, never on its fruits. And what I learned from that is, as hard as it is, I gotta keep focus on the action I take. And I have to, I mean, I tell people, they'll say, what should I do here or there? And I'll say, this is what I would have done. Well, it will guarantee that they'll respond. I have no idea how it'll respond. That's out of my hands. What I must do is I must make amends for that. I must take that action. I must make that phone call. I must take that minute in prayer. It won't guarantee me a damn thing. it does increase the likelihood I'll get those things, but I have to have my focus be on the action in front of me and to let go to the best of my ability on what will manifest from that action. I'm powerless over it. I don't have a clue, and so they say it doesn't matter. So if I eat clean and the weight doesn't go down any given week, you know what? I still need to get to eat clean the next day and the next week. Eventually it'll go down. That's science. But pretty much the other thing's the same way. I don't know that everybody will respond well to my amends. I have to make it not matter. I've got to do them, and what'll be, it'll be. But again, my two cents.
Time for one more question. Let's go with him. So how do we deal with watching out for complacency and when we don't feel like doing a big old 10th step on it, so we just kind of say, oh, well, the defect must have been this and move on. Anybody want to talk on that?
Go for it. I had some kind of minor surgery on my forehead on Wednesday, and the reason for the glasses is my eyes are really puffed out. Everything on my face got swollen from here up. And my head hurts. And last night, my wife wrote me an email. Yesterday afternoon, she wrote me an email from work and saying, you know, if you're not feeling good, you don't have to go tomorrow. That was real tempting. I mean, I like coming here, but I live in the valley, and, it's a schlep. This morning, she reminded me I don't have to go. And she rattled off the names of all the people in recovery that she knows that are friends of mine with a lot of time. And she said, you know, Don P. and this one, they'd cover what's Terrell doing today. It was real easy to stay home. It was nice and toasty. Our dog, God bless her, she doesn't feel well, but she's so clingy right now, which, no offense, I love. And so we were all sitting there in bed, and I had every reason not to get up, every reason not to shower, and a dang good excuse. I could not keep a straight face and justify that it would have been the right thing to do. I couldn't do it. I wanted to be able to, both because I'm a codependent kiss ass and I want to be able to say to my wife, you're right, honey, and I'll stay home and be with you. I want to do that because I'm a people pleaser. But I could not justify not meeting my commitment because I'm more than capable of driving here. I'm more than capable of speaking. And I the tone in your voice when you asked the question was magnificent. If I say something, well, I didn't lie, but when I start talking like that, I'm not a good actor. I can't even fool myself anymore. I better, when I have that challenge, own what's real. Because that, in answer to all the questions about the unraveling of recovery, that to me is just, it's right there in front of me. And that would have been a real easy one to just excuse. I can't do it anymore. I probably will again, but just for today, I can't do it again.
You know, I wanted to also address, you know, when you talk about like, oh, this is not a big deal, it's not a big deal, it's not a big deal, until it becomes a big deal. Then I deal with it. Because there's a lot of little annoyances and irritations in our lives. That's just part of life, stepping life on life's terms. But I know when I get a very strong reaction, and, you know, when I had said that it starts in the mind, it took a while before I went into the food. So I left it unattended for a long time. So now I try to catch up. You know what? This has happened before. You know what? This has happened a little bit repeatedly. Then I start to write. So when things are really, you know, I have a pause now and the room that I can still stay abstinent and have these things happen until I can't ignore it anymore, then I deal with it.
All right. Thank you to our timer, Margaret, and to you all for participating in this panel discussion. And I'm actually going to go ahead and go off script because it says after the Serenity Prayer, please clear the room as soon as possible because there may be another panel. There's no other panel. Hang out, have drinks, talk, you know, mingle. The room's fine until 2 p.m. So that's it. Would everyone who cared, thank you for allowing us to be of service. And would everyone who cared to please join us in the Serenity Prayer.